Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip. Through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
Well, welcome to Fire Service Court Radio. This is John Murphy, retired deputy fire chief and attorney at law. And again, I'm flying solo this evening as my cohort attorneys are out doing important lawyerly things somewhere. I know that a couple of them are teaching and other ones have evening meetings with their clients. So you're pretty much stuck with me for the duration of this radio show. And so what we're going to do tonight is to make it a little bit eclectic in the areas of topic. We're going to be doing what I classify in my law school bar exam as an inch deep and a mile wide amount of information. And hopefully that you will find interest in some of these topics and go off and do some research yourself. But we are attorneys that will be speaking at the FDIC. I'll be there also speaking at the GEMS conference, which is cohabitating, I guess, with the FDIC conference, all in April 2022 in Indianapolis, and hope to see you and 35,000 of your cohort firefighters and EMT and physicians and other providers in Indianapolis in April 2020. So a couple of things that have kind of popped to the surface, which attracted me, my attention, was again, in, you know, in spite of the fact that we have been talking about the pitfalls and perils of using social media, we continue again in 2022 with a social media event, which is, you know, for some of us, it's a career ender. And for others of us, it's, you know, litigation that we probably need to defend in some form or fashion with terminations. But this one is a Houston Fire Department posted on his Facebook of a working house fire where eight members of the family were displaced. And his caption on there was "staying warm this morning," which is wrong in so many ways, can hardly describe it. But again, social media is a tool to be used judiciously. I know that in the fire service, we have a tendency to put our grievances and bitches out on there. But certainly as members of the public and public safety officers, we have a certain obligation to the public to stay off social media as it deals, especially with fire department issues, and especially working fire calls where families are displaced. You know, people die, firefighters are critically injured and die. Social media is really not the forum to put your, you know, think you're being funny on there, and actually you're not. And we'll see what happens to this Houston firefighter at the end of the day when they do a review of this particular posting, and also take a look at their policies for the department. And a word to the wise is make sure you do have a policy on any electronic media, social media, Facebook, you know, any of those sorts of things. I know that my kids tell me that Facebook is for the old people, and now everybody's going to TikTok and other sorts of things. Technology has probably outpaced most of us baby boomers, but it's the up, you know, the young and upcoming that are going to be affected by all of the social media demands, ask for information, and, you know, thinking we're doing a public service by putting those sorts of things on our Facebook or our social postings, and really you're not. We again continue to discriminate against people of color or women. One of the cases that are up in Wichita, Kansas, is that there's a failure to promote a black firefighter in the upper ranks. Apparently there's collusion to prevent, or actually to modify performance evaluations and falsify signatures that he accepted the evaluation, where in fact he did not, and it was a failure to promote him to battalion chief or a chief officer position, and discovered a lot of things that had gone on in the department that made it impossible for him to promote, and now he will sue the department. The request is for a $40,000 or $75,000 award, which is, you know, pretty small. I think at the end of the day, we'll see a larger award and probably a promotion and maybe a change in leadership of the organization to make sure that people of color, women, all the other protected classes are not discriminated against by someone who does not want another person promoted in their organization. With the COVID sort of still an ongoing issue after almost 2 years, we still have issues dealing with responders not treating COVID patients I'm not sure exactly where this was, but I'm thinking it is in California. Rialto City Fire Department last year in December, essentially would not go into a nursing home to treat a patient who was in a cardiac arrest. After a lot of, wrangling, the police officer went in, drugged the patient out on his bed with the assistance of the nursing home staff, and resuscitation occurred in the field, actually literally in the field, and the patient was transported to the hospital, and he subsequently died. This one, the troubling part of it is, first of all, the activity occurred. The second, there is actually no denial that the activity occurred because there is body camera footage, mostly likely worn by a police officer demonstrating refusal of the fire department paramedics to enter the nursing home, claiming that there's a law on the books in California that indicates that we're not allowed to go into a COVID area, and especially a nursing home, and the California Emergency Medical Services Authority told the fire chief and, you know, news media, obviously they're all over this, that paramedics cannot refuse to treat patients. And again, we have talked about this before. Do we have a duty to respond? And while you're on duty and in uniform and on the job, you do have a duty to respond. And the only, I think, exclusion to that is maybe in protocol, where they have a barricaded suspect or an incident that may have a high incidence of explosion or, you know, other sorts of things that may occur to personnel and to equipment and to the surrounding neighborhoods. But upon acceptance of a call assignment, California paramedics cannot refuse service unless directed by law enforcement, if they're on the scene or they're ordered to stage away because of the danger of the scene. And then obviously it's up to the local protocols and those who direct your particular programs. But the overarching aspect, I think, of this particular section is that we have an obligation to the patient to treat. And unless there's an immediate life threat to you and your partner and others that are responding and you're ordered to stand away or there's been direction given to stand away by law enforcement, you do have an obligation to treat and transport patients. So let that not occur to you. One of the another interesting thing that's going on is with the PFAS, the cancer-causing chemicals that we are now finding in our protective clothing. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. When I came into the fire service in 1973, we never even thought that, you know, our bunker clothing could be hazardous to our health. But as we're finding out currently, there is a huge issue with cancer-causing material that's in our fire protective clothing. And also in the fire foam that we're using, AFFF foam at a high level of PFAS in there. And I'm not even going to pretend to pronounce this because I'd probably blow it, and I know that I will. And I actually typed the name into a speech program so I could hear what it said. It took me 4 or 5 times to listen to it, and I've just decided not even to go there and just call it by initial PFAS. And so We're seeing this issue on military bases. There was a section or a session on the news last night where at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, there's some retired Marines that have been exposed to these sort of chemicals in the drinking water and now have all kinds of cancers that they're dealing with in their retirement where they shouldn't even have to be there. So I guess the news of the day today is that there's firefighters in Massachusetts and New York that filed a lawsuit. This was dated February 16th, at least the bulletin was. And I'm sure that the litigation was filed prior to this article. And it says the case is the latest in a growing number of lawsuits from firefighters' attorneys citing concerns that chemicals, per PFAS, found in their protective jackets and pants and other gear, and specializing firefighting foam, especially AFFF, is causing an increase in risk of cancer or liver damage and other cancerous illnesses and illnesses in general. And so the cause of action, again, in this one is the PFAS in our protective clothing, the PFASs that we're exposed to when using AFFF foam many years ago, which has pretty much been discontinued. And I know that in my fire district here in Western Washington, after I retired, of course, thank God, there is an increased level of PFAS in the drinking water in the city that we had our headquarters fire station in, pretty much directly related to the use of our AFFF foam during training in a downtown training facility, which put us kind of in a liable driver's seat for a period of time. But I'm not sure whether that has been resolved with a fine or it's an ongoing sort of an event. But anyways, there's an attorney firm in New York that's representing the clients. There's another attorney's firm in Massachusetts representing the clients. And then some attorneys are being admitted, which is from out of state, other states, under a rule called Pro Hac Vice, which indicates that I in Washington can actually practice law on these cases in Massachusetts if I'm invited to and I have a client back there, and I'll just tag on to these sort of lawsuits. So I think it's incumbent on you as firefighters and your departments to take a look at what is going on in your department. And again, this contaminant is very much inherent in our current bunker clothing. One of the legislators, I think in one of the East Coast states had secured some money in Biden's, one of Biden's budgets for about $80 million. So firefighters in his state could purchase new bunker clothing that are PFAS free. And also allow other firefighters around the country to utilize those monies to purchase new bunker clothing. But I think your organization needs to recognize, what sort of bunker clothing do they have? Is the material and the chemical compounds in there? And then what do we need to do to replace all of that sort of stuff with non-contaminated bunker clothing? Which sort of brings up this question. This question is, if you are exposed to PFAS and you suffer the side effects of those, is this a presumptive illness in your state? And so there's an article in the National Cancer Institute Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics, which talks about the PFAS exposures and risks of cancer. Without, detail, you can pull the article up if you so choose. It's located at the National Cancer Institute homepage, and they talk about PFAS and what types of cancers do occur as a result of these exposures over time. Certainly kidney cancer, because there's all, everything that we eat and drink circulate through the kidneys or a gigantic filter, as is the liver. And so these chemicals are deposited in those filtration systems and could cause a cancerous growth in there and cause you issues, certainly. Testicular cancer, ovarian and endometrial cancer, prostate cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma and thyroid cancers, and childhood leukemia. And they're talking about some studies that are going on in Finland, talking about the exposures to PFAS in the maternal patients, the moms, and then in the drinking water, and maybe if they're firefighters, if that sort of bunker clothing exposure would cause maternal cancers or like leukemias, which is a cancer. And then there's also a big push for drinking water purity around the country. I know that the government has been and always has been taking a look at ensuring that we have drinking water that is safe for everyone. And but it's a huge issue because apparently, you know, some chemical manufacturers will dump their byproducts into the drinking water or the water table, and unfortunately, we end up drinking it. One of the this doesn't have much to do with the PFAS thing, but when I was in Hawaii over the holidays, the Navy had a huge leak of JP4 and other fuels from underground storage tanks that have been there since World War II. And contaminated the drinking water. So people got irritations and rashes and all kinds of stuff. And it was fairly significant content of fuel products in their drinking water, which leached into the aquifer. And of course, the Navy and the government was in the denial stage, was in the, well, this is not going to hurt you. And then finally migrated to the fact that, yeah, these are harmful. They moved a lot of their residents off bases that depending on the water supply. And, you know, it's a huge mess. And so I think we have an obligation, again, to protect ourselves and to work, do everything we can to prevent cancers from these sort of exposures that, you know, for a long period of time were an unknowing factor or unknown factor. When we're using AFFF or when we're wearing our bunker clothing on a consistent basis while we're on duty. So anyway, that article, again, was found in the National Cancer Institute Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics. And make sure that if you're interested, and we all should be as firefighters, that you do the research and talk to your department. Talk to the manufacturer, the provider of the bunker clothing that you have. If you do contain that chemical or those chemicals, then I think it's incumbent on you as a firefighter and your organization to ensure your safety. And part of that is making sure you have hazard-free bunker and protective clothing available for your use on a daily basis. So sort of the last topic today, which particularly kind of infuriated me when I read it, was, and I wrote an article on it for Fire Engineering Magazine, which was posted a couple of days ago, dealing with the N-word and free speech. And so the article basically starts out with the Delaware County, Pennsylvania District Attorney's Office recently announced plans to investigate allegations that a volunteer firefighter from the Briarcliff Fire Company used racial slurs and disparaged black residents in a late January conversation following a virtual meeting. So, you know, it was sort of that hot mic event that firefighters in this particular fire company were making disparaging remarks. One, I think, which infuriated not only the district attorney, but probably everybody else that heard it, was one Briarcliff volunteer allegedly mocking the name of an 8-year-old girl that got shot outside of a high school football game in Sharon Hill some time back. And then the district attorney goes on to say that whether or not a crime occurred, hate speech is always always morally wrong. And it does not reflect the people who live here in Darby Township. And it doesn't really reflect the people who live in Delaware County. And in spite of the fact that this is Black History Month, words always matter. And especially when expressed in mockery, taunting, or to create harm, or to infuriate an audience. And again, I'll emphatically state that this is unacceptable behavior on part of the firefighters or anyone dealing with the public or anyone dealing with anyone, that using these sorts of words to diminish, to humiliate, to hassle, to harass is not wrong. And I'm for one, and I'm not the innocent person here, and I don't claim innocence, but certainly this is 2022. We're in a different environment, and I think we need to watch our words because words matter. There's a great article written by a Dr. John McWhorter, that's McWhorter, who writes, and he's a linguist at the, where is this gentleman working? Stand by for a second. Let me look at my references. We wrote it for the New York Times article, and then is an associate professor of linguistics at Columbia University, and he indicates that the N-word, and I'm not going to use the word, and we all know what the word is, was essentially a contemptuous word used by the Europeans for the Africans and later African descended people. And then its evolution from slur to unspeakable obscenity was part of the gradual prohibition on avowed racism and the slurring of groups. And again, it's a part of a larger cultural shift, according to his article. So I would encourage you to read the article and read my article, and it'll give you the link to Dr. McWhorter's his article in the New York Times. And it's, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted. So if harsh words offend you, then I recommend that you don't read it. But even if they do offend you, you got to read this stuff, because I think it makes us a lot smarter and a lot more cognizant of the fact that what we say as public safety officers, and especially even recorded or unrecorded, it creates an impact on our organization. I go on to say that the N-word in the fire station or on the street or in your daily discourse has different meanings to the speaker, the audience, or the target. And we all react with some sort of horror, anger, or resentment that we had to hear the word when directed to one of our coworkers or a group of our colleagues. There are certain areas of the country where the N-word is used almost on a constant basis amongst blacks themselves. And even when I have traveled to the fire station, especially in the South where the predominant firefighter population is black, the N-word is used quite frequently in greetings and, you know, lots of other contexts. And for me as a, you know, a Caucasian man, it's like raises the hackles on the back of my neck. But, you know, what's one to do in order to correct that behavior, especially when you're a guest in their environment? Today's fire services, more than 7.8% of our firefighters are black, where the predominant firefighter race is white. And the United States population, is predominantly white at 57%. Hispanics make 18%, and African Americans make up 12%. You know, black Americans have been in the fire service for a long period of time, where the first black woman firefighter was in New York. And there's been, you know, progression of firefighters of all colors and all races and all genders who have come into our department over time, where it was predominantly a white person's industry and environment. So the question is the use of the N-word hate speech or hurtful speech? Then hate speech is defined as speech in any form of public expression of hate through which the speakers intend to vilify, humiliate, or incite hatred against a group or class of persons on the basis of race, religion, skin color, sexual identity, gender, ethnicity, disability, or national origin. And the N-word is not the only word used as a slur, and there's a ton of them out there, which I think Dr. McWhorter goes through and lists a lot of them. But, you know, as an Irishman, we have our own twist on what it means to be Irish, Jewish, Polish, Italian. You know, all of the sort of the groups out there have slang, nicknames, or words that are harmful or hurtful, and I think we just need to recognize you know, what those words mean to other people and then how they harm them, because it certainly is not helpful. And so the question again, is it protected by the First Amendment, which we all know is the right to free speech? And so in our country, unless it crosses the line and becomes incitement or fighting words or a true threat, hate speech is protected by the First Amendment as noted in past court rulings. And then the most recent demonstrations of the United States, and probably by some people in your social media feeds as well, are, you know, using those First Amendment privileges to incite riots and incite hateful or hurtful speech as well. There is a case a number of years ago. We've all heard the term shouting fire in a crowded theater. And so even though that's not right and it creates mass chaos and possible death and injury, the theory of yelling fire in a movie theater was a sort of a paraphrase of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr.'s opinion in the United States Supreme Court in Chenick v. United States in 1919, which held that defendant speech in opposition to the draft during World War I was not protected free speech under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The case was later partially overturned by Brandenburg v. Ohio in 1969, which limited the scope of banned speech to what would be directed to and likely incite imminent lawless action, such as a riot. There are also, you know, instances where certain forms of speech can be regulated and banned, such as when speech challenges the military and harms a war effort during the Espionage Act of 1970 during World War I. And again, the Brandenburg v. Ohio 69 case certainly sort of modified that hard and fast rule that it could cause harm to people. And so people, again, are invited to engage in whatever verbal or nonverbal speech they so desire based on that court case. And again, it's a, you know, in my experiences and probably your experiences, if you've been in the service or you've been in any other industry or, you know, depending on the area of the country that you live in, the N-word and other, I guess, jingoistic words directed at or towards people, you know, either in jest or in some sort of you're irritated or angry and the only words that you can use are racially offensive words. It happens. And I'm not making an excuse for it, and actually I'm horrified by it. And so encountered in these or engaged in these sort of discussions or overhearing other people making those slurs. Do I speak up? And I have to say, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. And so it depends a lot on the situation and my location that I'm in. But I think I would more likely speak up against those sorts of words and, try to protect basically my integrity and hopefully will blunt the effect that would have on the person who is the target. We've always, it's kind of interesting that we as a country have used hurtful or demeaning speech, especially during times of war, that we demean or dehumanize those that are fighting as it places us in a superior position to our enemy. And I personally can recite about 50 or more slurs used towards the enemy, both foreign and domestic, but certainly in this presentation and even in my writing, I did not. But if those of you who have been in, and probably not a lot of us left from World War II, Korea and Vietnam and, the Middle East and Iraq and Afghanistan, we always have these words that we would call the local population to put them in a sort of a subhuman position. And the reason that I think we did that, and according to the research, was it was easier to kill those people if they're subhuman or dehumanized in our eyes. And so the responsibility for us taking a life was less consequential than if they were, you know, like us. And there wasn't that sort of demeaning or dehumanizing language to describe them. Certainly, I was a Navy corpsman with the Marine Corps stationed in Vietnam for a while. And, you know, you heard about everything you hear either in person, some of the movies that they have about Vietnam certainly demonstrated that sort of bias towards the fighting troops and the local civilian population. And so did it make it right? No. Did it make it, easier for the military to do their job? It probably did. But it's insensitive language. And so we can truthfully say that insensitive language given with the intent to harm or a slip of the tongue or in the heat of the moment can harm those on the receiving end of our inarticulate utterances. And then the language has a long-term lasting effect on our employees as well. So if you're you know, a fire officer, a firefighter, and, you know, you're the chief of the department using, you know, slurs and harassing language towards your own firefighters, that hurts the organization. And so a lot of our departments, and you should have, if you don't already have, policies that address these issues in the form of anti-bullying, anti-harassment, anti-discrimination, a set of codes of conduct and ethical standards. And, you know, the lawyers, we've talked about codes of conduct and ethical standards because it's impossible to write a policy on every possible thing that could go on in the fire department. And so we do these ethical codes or codes of conduct. So, you know, if you violate a code of conduct, and there's a number of cases out there where employees have violated, you know, there's really no policy to slot them into, but it's a code of conduct thing. And that also addresses off-duty conduct as well. And I think there's a recent issue with a couple of firefighters going to a promotional event in a bar, got into a brawl. We're intoxicated and that sort of stuff. And so they're being disciplined as a result of, you know, the sort of the code of conduct and ethical standards. I mean, there's probably not a policy in the in that department that says thou shalt not take a fire truck to a bar and get drunk and, you know, participate in a promotional process. That doesn't happen. But the department has a code of conduct. And so the code of conduct was violated in this particular case. And so there's going to be discipline coming down on these guys. So, you know, I don't want to be the word police here, but let's take a look at how we talk to each other, how we respect each other, how we approach each other. There's a lot more examples of offensive behavior that have been recorded, witnessed, and litigated than ever before. And I think people are just getting fed up with this sort of racial hatred, hatred towards one party or the other, or one person towards the other. And I think we're in a position where there's going to be a lot more litigation that goes on, not only in our institution of the fire service, but other businesses around the country. And I think, you know, a good example right now is one of the probably the largest employers is getting charged with creating a racially harassing environment. That's Tesla. And so Tesla we'll be facing some serious litigation that goes on because it's the culture of permissiveness that allows the behaviors, the language, those sorts of things that demean and degrade those that may not look like me or act like me or be like me. And there's, again, a number of cases in the private sector, especially in the engineering firms, where a lot of racial bias cases have been presented for litigation, and unfortunately, the individuals who actually want to work there are the victims or the targets of these sort of this harassing behavior. So again, in today's modern society, the N-word is used all too frequently, and certainly is an embarrassment to the Briarcliff Fire Department. And I would, you know, say without reservation that it should be an embarrassment to you and us in the fire service that we have to relate or sort of demean or diminish ourselves when we call our fellow firefighters who we depend on for our backs and our health and safety a word that is clearly offensive. So with that, I am done. I hope that this last presentation stimulates a little bit of conversation and, you know, hopes to redirect you into maybe or to think more about how I approach people, how I talk to people, how I think about people. And I think at the end of the day, it all makes us a better society and certainly a better fire service for our community. So until next month, where hopefully we get all the attorneys in one pile, we will see you in Indianapolis, FDIC, April, I think, 23rd to the 30th, whole week's worth of fun with 30,000 plus of your firefighters, EMS people, doctors, and other professionals in our profession. So until that time, take care, be safe, and good night.